You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Joan Snyder, an artist who lives and works in Brooklyn and Woodstock. She's been the recipient of numerous awards, among which is the MacArthur Fellowship. She has had shows at numerous galleries over the years, including Betty Cunningham in New York City and Nielsen Gallery in Boston. Her gallery in Woodstock is the Elena Zhang Gallery. Joan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, Brainerd.
To begin with, what's happening in your Woodstock now, in your studio now? I know you're in Woodstock and you have a studio and a gallery there as well. What are you working on today or these days?
Well, at the moment, my Woodstock studio is not my active studio. I'm working in Brooklyn, but I just happened to be here for a few days. But I did do some work this summer. I think I got quite a few good paintings done this summer and then moved back to Brooklyn where I'm just beginning to work again. But this summer I worked on, well, what ended up to be some very dark field paintings, one of which I call Meditation on a Dark Field. Not having intended to make these dark field paintings, but that's kind of what happened once I got started. So I don't know. Now I'm continuing in the studio in Brooklyn on what I think might be a very large painting based on The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. I've been known to do things like this from time to time, really large paintings based on, like I did one on William Blake's poem, Ah, Sunflower, with all the text in the painting. So I don't know, that's sort of what I'm thinking about and starting to work on.
And will those paintings be part of an upcoming show in particular?
Well, I've been without a New York gallery for about 3 years now, and I'm on the precipice, on the edge of a new representation in the city. So I think I will, probably within a year, I would guess, be having an exhibition of new paintings. You know, nothing's set in stone yet, but I'm hoping.
Okay. So let's move back a little bit, perhaps to your childhood or early beginnings. What was your first experience with art of any kind that perhaps made you think, either in retrospect or at the moment, that you were interested in the arts or attracted to visual art?
Well, when I was probably preteen, I don't even remember, but I made a studio in the basement in my house in Highland Park, New Jersey, a little studio, and I was doing things like copying Utrillo paintings and making certain paintings of my own. And then that ended abruptly or not abruptly, but I stopped doing that. And I know that there was a love for it when I was doing it. And this was surrounded by a childhood that was probably more anxiety-ridden than anything else. But I did love being in the basement painting. But then I went to college and was a sociology major and decided to take a painting course in my senior year in college and managed to talk them out of making me take 101, you know, drawing and color and all the things you're supposed to do. And I just took a painting course with a professor named Billy Pritchard. And he saw a painting that I was working on, and I knew nothing about art. I mean, I was just absolutely culturally deprived. My family, I think I had probably never been to a museum, which
so
is hard to
so your
believe.
Family weren't big supporters of the arts or something, or encouraging.
They were working class and not encouraging me, and you know, I mean, they encouraged me to go to college, but not, you know, the word art was never spoken in the house. So, you know, I took this painting course with Billy Pritchard, and I made a painting of my brother and sister-in-law, which was, you know, and he said to me, Oh my God, do you know Yavolensky? And I had no idea who Yavolensky was. He dragged me up to the slide room and showed me German expressionist paintings and paintings from that era, and it changed my life. You know, so I looked at this stuff, and there was a painting by Yavolensky that was using similar colors. Similar, it was a man with a pipe, and I come from a Jewish, Russian, German background, and of course I immediately identified and related to what he was showing me, and from then on, you know, everything changed. I mean, it was, you know, I knew I wanted to be a painter very early on, but I also knew that I was not a good painter and that it would take me many years to become good or proficient or whatever. And I gave myself many assignments and, you know, really was self-educated until I went to Rutgers Graduate School a couple of years later.
So you took off a few years between school and continued painting on your own and essentially teaching yourself.
Right. I was a sociology major, so I got jobs in anti-poverty programs and was able to paint. Rented myself a studio in the Raritan River and painted, and then literally marched into Rutgers graduate program with a carload of paintings and showed them to, I think it was Reginald Neal was the head of the department. You know, I just said, can I show you some paintings? And it was nothing, you know, nothing professional or well. And he said, you know, they let me into the program non-matriculated for a year because they were convinced enough about what I showed them that they let me in, even though I had only had that one undergraduate course. So I went non-matriculated for a year, and then the next year I matriculated and you know, had a wonderful experience at Rutgers because of all the you know, people that were there studying with me. I mean, it was really a great experience with Jackie Windsor, Keith Saunier, John Geldersmaa. I mean, there was Linda Jeanfreau. There was, anyway, we all just were working very hard, and it was a great experience. So in 3 years, I got my master's degree.
And then what was your next step? You were
and then my next step was to stay in New Brunswick for a year because I had to make, I mean, no one was supporting me. I had to make enough money to move to the city. So I stayed in New Brunswick and I worked and I painted in my studio on George Street in an apartment. And then the next year, a group of us, Keith, Jackie, myself, Mark Berger, who was our professor, rented a building at 105 Mulberry Street. And it was a building that was absolute, had no plumbing. It had one toilet on the second floor. So the four of us probably spent the next few years, you know, renovating each of our floors and getting plumbing and, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, that was my beginning in the city.
And so you immediately had the kind of a group of artists or some kind of, would you call it a support system, people who are encouraging within that building, within that new context or social group that was being created just by renovating this building?
I think that it was a support group. I mean, I think we really did visit each other's studios, and I mean, it was easy. You know, that was easy to do in those. And yeah, I mean, definitely.
And how was it that you got your first show in New York, and how did it, and how did you navigate as an artist? I know when I interviewed Mary Heilman, and she talked about there being something of a boys' club at that time and kind of difficult to get into it. What was your experience as a woman in New York at that time with a studio trying to find a gallery or get a show?
Well, my strategy was to find, you know, try to get some galleries to look at my work. And what I was lucky enough to do was I found Klaus Curtis, who owned or ran Bikert Gallery at the time. And Klaus was a very generous, open, young art dealer who came to my studio probably over a period of 2 years. You know, he would come down. I mean, this is in 1969. And he would look at the work and he would say, let me know when you have another body of work. And then 6 months later, he'd come again. And I think after about 2 years, and I was making the stroke paintings then, you know, what are known as the stroke paintings in 1970,
right.
I think. He came to the studio and he asked me if I would be in a group show at his gallery. He put me in a group show of, you know, I think it was me and two other painters. And he didn't, you know, Klaus didn't want to represent me necessarily, but he did tell Marcia Tucker about my work, or Marcia saw it there. I think he might have told her. And Marcia came to the studio and ended up doing a big article in Art Forum about me, which was kind of amazing. But he also told a young couple who were about to open a gallery, Jeff Paley and Jill and Lowe, about me. And they were very interested in representing me in their new gallery. And it was on Worcester Street, Lower Worcester. And I accepted. And that's where I had my first one-person show. Although I think that I did have a one-person show with Michael Walls before that, who had a gallery in San Francisco. Because I remember there was a poster that he made, a picture of me on that Larry Fink, who was my former husband, took of me lying on a bed with my legs sort of splayed, and it said, Joan Snyder, first one-man show. And of course it was all printed and sent out, and I went crazy because he called it a one-man show. But in those days, that's what you called it. One person show, you say it's a one man show. Anyway, I think I did have a show with Michael, but then I showed at Paley and Lowe, and really things took off from there.
But then throughout this time you were obviously supporting yourself in New York by working different jobs.
Oh yeah, working two or three jobs at once, part time. I mean, my thing was that I always wanted studio time in the morning. I mean, that's when I work, and it's still when I work. So I would accept any job, you know, afternoon, I mean, or evening. So I would have two or three part-time jobs, usually in the afternoons, to support myself. And be as long as I was able to work in the morning in the studio, I didn't really care. And I think those jobs really were also connected with the Upward Bound programs. And I mean, I remember I had a job at Yeshiva University that was doing a program in Bedford-Stuyvesant, so I would go to Bedford-Stuyvesant and do art classes with the students. And you know, I was doing some innovative way to teach kids art, which had nothing to do with turkeys on Thanksgiving or Santas on Christmas. I was really teaching them about,
right,
you know, using it as another language. And so that was very exciting for me because I love child art and I love working with these kids. And they made gorgeous work. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then I began selling my work. And I don't remember. I mean, I think I always worked, even after I was selling my work, I was having jobs.
But at
I couldn't.
Some point
you
that,
you
that,
could
that
in those days you couldn't get a teaching job if you were a woman. So I could not get a position, you know, at a university at all. But what I did get after I began to be known, what I did get was I got invited all over in different parts of the country. I was kind of the token woman painter. So in all these art departments all over the country that didn't have women on their faculty, I was invited because they needed to have a woman out there. I was invited. I gave lectures in Kansas and in Colorado and California, you know, all over the place. So that's another way that I made money during those years.
And this is in the 70s, we're talking about early, mid-70s.
This is in the early 70s, yeah.
And then as you were continuing to show with Pally, how did your career grow? Was it the stroke paintings, as they've been called, is what first got you a lot of attention, or
Yes, those got me a lot of attention, and then I think Pally and Lowe closed, and I kind of burned out. I mean, I remember that there were lists of people who wanted work. I mean, it was, I never made more than 10 or 12 paintings a year, and people wanted them. And at that time, Larry and I bought a farm in Pennsylvania around 1973. And I remember just completely being so totally confused by the New York art world, because I was suddenly collecting friends like you collect butterflies. I didn't know who was my friend and who wasn't my friend. And I was, when you become known and you're young, it can be very, very difficult. And it became difficult for me. And we moved out to this farm in Pennsylvania, and I began making, and of course the women's movement had started in the early 70s sometime,
and so
there was a whole dialogue about, is there such a thing as a female sensibility? And what happened to me was I totally shifted gears. I stopped making the stroke paintings completely, and I started making these very kind of feminist paintings that I had no idea how they would be accepted or not accepted, but I was on a different trajectory altogether. Moving out to the farm with Larry, and I suddenly had this kind of peace and quiet and could really just make these outrageous feminist type paintings.
And so what at that time you were still showing, or did you really feel like you kind of dropped out of the art?
At that time, I think what happened was that Pally and Lowe stopped. They closed their gallery. And what happened was that I got a call from a dealer in Ohio named Carl Soloway, who I still have a close relationship with. And Carl called me and said, he said, I'm renting a space with a few other dealers in the city. And he's from Ohio, from Cincinnati. And he said, we're going to try to open a gallery in the city, and I want to show your paintings. And I said, well, Carl, everything's changed. You have no idea what's going on. So he flew out and came to my studio in Pennsylvania, and he saw my brand new paintings that had nothing to do with the stroke paintings whatsoever. And or maybe they did, because there's always a continuation. But anyway, he looked at them. He ended up, to make a longer story short, he ended up buying a few. He ended up showing them. I don't think they sold easily, but they did eventually sell. And so that's how I showed those, with Carl, who really had a relatively temporary space in the city. And I think after that, I probably showed, then I went to Hamilton Gallery, where Pat Hamilton was opening a new space on 57th Street. Was lucky, things moved along, not in a bad way for me in gallery wise.
And then, how was it socially then? As you were saying, it was, very confusing for a young artist. So you're
right.
A little bit older now, but not much older. You're back in the city. Did you have a different sense of friends and the social scene that made you more comfortable?
Well, I think what we had then in the mid-70s was, not only was I very involved in starting this women artist series at Douglas College. I mean, that was a lot of work and very exciting to me. But we also, the women's movement was well underway. So, and I was involved in Heresies, and I was involved in some of the anti-war movement groups. And so my involvement was political at that point. I'm good at political. I was enjoyed the political groups, and then I was home painting. And I think that for me, almost after the women's movement and after that all sort of faded away a bit, there never has been a community of artists for me. I mean, I can't safely say that I have artist friends in the city. I mean, I do have a few friends, and probably they're just, you know, really from way back in the women's movement that I feel very near to, close to.
And why is that? Because that was a moment in time, in history of a certain kind of, you know, hope, ferment, possibility. I mean, that's kind of fascinating to hear. Why do you think that created such close relationships?
Well, to begin with, because we got together once a week, or maybe sometimes more. So we were, you know, we were very caught up in the women's movement. I mean, it was a very exciting time. We worked very hard. I mean, there was an excitement about women's work, you know, and the fact that women were there and working, and in fact, students all over the country, young women working, and you know, there was a great desire to support them. And for me, I was not involved in the women's movement because I needed to make it as a woman. I was doing well. I mean, I was doing fine. But I really believed in the women's movement, you know, in feminism, and I still do. But, you know, that was my community at the time. After that, I can safely say I didn't have a community, and I don't have a community, and I don't, you know, I, at the end of the 70s, I was caught up in my own personal life, which, you know, I always have been.
I'm sorry, go on. Yeah, you had.
No, go, you can ask me.
By caught up in your personal life, and you said it as you always have been, and now we're in the early 80s. Yeah, can you tell me a little more about what does that mean?
In the late 70s, well, what it meant was that I was living on the farm with Larry, and I had an abortion, which was, of course, fraught. And then I got pregnant again, and then I had a miscarriage. And then I got pregnant again, and then I had a baby. So that was like 3.5-4 years of you know, being caught up in my personal life, which, you know, and then I had a baby, and then I when she was 9 months old, I left Larry and I left the farm and I moved back to the loft on Mulberry Street and with a 9 month old, I was very busy with that because the place needed total renovation to live there with a child, and there was not even a bathtub or a shower or anything. It was just a kitchen sink. So, you know, so I was caught up in my own personal life. I always kept working. I mean, somehow I managed to always keep working 2 or 3 or 4 hours a day in the morning. And I always kept very stridently working. But that didn't mean I had time to, you know, do anything else besides that and take care of a child. Because I was a single mother for about 7 or 8 years.
I would think that's enormously difficult. I can't imagine
How
it would have been just to survive as a single mother with the demands of a child, which,
right.
You know, I also have a child, but, you know, I certainly didn't raise him alone. But to also be pursuing life as a painter in New York with his child, I would think is, you know, was not what the community of artists were doing at that time.
No, it was very, very hard. I mean, you know, and it was like, for me, I remember being very depressed, and it was like putting one foot in front of the other. It was very depressing leaving my marriage because I really loved my husband, but, you know, things just really didn't work out. We were married for about 10 or 12 years at that point. We didn't have Molly until we were married for over 10 years. And it was very, very hard, and you know, mostly I was concentrating on my painting and the language I was developing and being very passionate about the painting and about my child. And there was almost nothing else that I wasn't involved with a group of people. I didn't go to Max's Kansas City. I didn't hang out. I didn't go to parties. I mostly didn't go to openings. I still don't, unless they're close friends. You know, in some ways, that sort of set the pattern of my life, which really has not been to hang out in the art world. And consequently, you know, I don't have those kind of connections in the art world. What can I say?
And, you know? Yeah, that's you know, sounds very human, and there's certainly plenty of people who also have that path. You know, it's that was your personality, and you also had a child.
Yeah.
So going to parties and going to openings also wasn't the most convenient thing to do either.
No. I think you know, with having a small baby child and all that, the thing that ended up liberating me a little bit, as opposed to having dinner alone with a little kid every night and having baby talk, is that at one point I realized, well, I have this big loft. I could have a kid living in with me, you know, like an older teenager or a 20-year-old living in with me, taking care of Molly, taking her to school, and liberating me a little bit. And that's what liberated me, you know, was when I discovered that I could have somebody living there with me. But anyway, it, you know, mostly my life has been about my work and my family, and not about the art world, which I've always found very difficult to navigate. And I mean, people look at my career and say, well, I know I'm very successful. I know I've done well. I know I'm very lucky. I know I've, you know, I mean, I have a great career. Which doesn't mean that I don't experience a glass ceiling for women, because I certainly do. But I do have a great career. But it hasn't been made because I've hung out in the art world, or have friends, or have connections, or anything like that. Because I feel like I really don't, or haven't, had that.
And when you say your work was essentially, or one of the things is it was about about family, what does that mean to you? Your work is about family.
No, I didn't say my work is about family. I said my life has been about work and my family. Yeah.
Which meant raising your daughter.
Yeah, which meant raising a child and you know, trying. My mantra in my life was, whatever my mother did, I was going to do exactly the opposite with my daughter, and it actually kind of worked. I mean, my mother was you know, quite negative and quite angry and quite verbally abusive in certain ways. You know, it just wasn't an easy childhood for me, you know, and I was not going to raise my kid that way. I mean, I was, you know, so you know, Molly was very adored. She came after I lost the baby, and she came after a miscarriage. And so, you know, it was really a very exciting kind of thing to have this child, in spite of the broken marriage. But anyway, so that really was what my life was about.
And then in the 80s, you know, Molly's growing up, you're having more shows. What's happening? Is that changing what's happening in your studio as she's getting older? Is she also painting there, or were there kind of influences by her?
Well, you know, there's you take a kid to the beach and they make a drawing in the sand, and then I made a painting, you know, based on that little stick figure in the sand. I mean, yeah, they're influence, you know, I mean, but I don't know. Molly was not really a hard child to raise, even though I was raising her alone until she was about 8 or 9. But when I met my now partner, wife, Maggie Kammer, Maggie and I started living together in about 87. But, you know, if you want to know what the mid-80s were like for me, your child is getting older, and so are your parents. So I became very caught up in taking care of my parents. So I had a child and parents that I had to take care of. You know, and all that kind of stuff ends up in the painting somehow. You know, it doesn't, because my work really is about my life in a lot of ways, even though I don't, you know, I don't like to admit that, or I don't like to necessarily talk about it that much, but it's there, you know. So at one point when my parents were both very sick, the paintings got very dark for a couple of years, and then I said, oh my God, these paintings are really dark. And so I started, you know, forcing myself to just mix a lot of colors and put colors in paintings. That's when I got back into some beautiful field paintings with lots of color. Anyway.
And then you're continuing to show, and in the late 80s, you meet your partner, which also must have been a big shift in how you're looking at the world, yourself, and I imagine happiness.
I was living, I had, Molly and I had moved to Eastport, Long Island, because I wanted her to be able to ride a bike and run around without worrying about her in the city. And then I met Maggie, and ultimately the three of us moved to a big apartment in Park Slope in Brooklyn. And yeah, things changed, moving back to the city and you know, just always keeping up the work and
that also sounds like another kind of liberation, you know, falling in love with this woman and having, you know, a different lifestyle altogether, I would imagine. And with your daughter, that sounds very embracing of who you are. And
there was a lot going on at once. Let's put it that way. Maggie was a judge, and she was not out yet. Molly, you know, Molly was, this was something, you know, relatively new to Molly to suddenly have kind of two mothers, or a stepmother and a mother. You know, so there's all that to navigate, and yeah, it was all very exciting, and we rented a big apartment and moved into the city, and Molly, I think, was in fifth grade at the time, and I got a studio not near the house, and so I, you know, in Park Slope, but it was unusual for me because I usually like to work where I live. But anyway, so the early 90s were about all of that, and it was all very exciting.
And Molly's growing up; she's a teenager now, and I guess in the 90s, and you continue to show in the city at a new gallery now, right? That was a, you're showing at a different gallery?
Herschel and Adler Modern, I think, came next.
Mm.
Yes, and they were on the Upper East Side.
To me, that sounds, I mean, I don't know if it was kind of the blue chip gallery it is now, but that's a kind of major gallery.
It was a major gallery, and I think I showed pumpkin fields and you know, some of the field paintings and things like that at the first show I had with them. But then I also had a show of very political paintings with them also, where I was making paintings about children all over the world being somehow abused or used, or, you know, so I had several shows with them. I don't know, I guess I've changed galleries a lot. And then Betty Cunningham was working there at Herschel and Adler Modern. And Betty and I formed a relationship, and then she went to work at Robert Miller, and then I moved to Robert Miller at a certain point with her. I think, I don't know if Herschel and Adler closed down, or, and then Betty opened her own gallery, and so I was affiliated with her for about 3 or 4 years in a gallery in Chelsea. That's my life.
it's fascinating and really interesting. And now we're into the 90s or 2000s, right? The beginning of the turn of the millennium. You're still moving around to galleries. You're getting a MacArthur Award. I don't know if that changed things for you, or was particularly significant to you, the MacArthur Award.
It's very particularly significant. I mean, it's kind of like a major, major event in one's life. You know, it made me feel like it was kind of an acknowledgement of many, many years of very hard work and devotion to my, you know, my life as a painter. So it was very exciting. And it also, Maggie and I had a place in Woodstock where I had a studio in the woods that had no plumbing, no, you know, there were bats, there were mice, there was no heat. But I loved it, you know, and I was off in the woods painting all the time. But at one point I said to her, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm getting too old to carry gallons of water up, you know, it's almost like two blocks up a hill to get to the studio. Anyway, what the MacArthur did was it allowed me to, you know, we kept looking for a different place where I could build a studio. And when I got to MacArthur, the very next day I saw an ad in the paper for a house that we could not have afforded before because I'd have to build a studio. So it allowed me to buy a house and build a studio, which I love. I'm sitting in it right now. It's just, you know, it's not a spectacular, fabulous studio, but for me it's like the biggest, best studio I've ever had, and it has plumbing and heat and everything.
Right. So it's something you could really, really appreciate.
I love it, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, it's I mean, the reason I asked you about that award is I was watching videos of Doris Lessing yesterday, who I guess you know passed away the day before.
Yeah, I heard that.
And, you know, she was so funny. You know, as she's getting out of a cab, they're basically, you know, there's a throng of reporters telling her she won the Nobel Prize in Literature. And she said, and they said, what do you think? And she said, well, you know, I couldn't really care less. And then she said, let me come out of my house for a minute. Let me go in the house. And she comes out of the house and she starts saying, she says, well, the Nobel Prize, she said, years ago they told me there was no way I was going to get it because they didn't like me. And as I remember, they even sent somebody here to tell me that I was not going to get that prize. And she said, so to me, they're just a bunch of bad-mannered people, and it's all about, you know, cutting the tape to a few moments later. Of course, I'm very grateful to receive for you know, this
answer. Oh, God, yeah.
But even then, she's, you know, she's giving a little speech when she finally had to give her a speech, and she said, look, she said, you know, I've won all kinds of awards, just about every award there is. So she said, I don't know where to go from here. I don't know where else I could go, except maybe the Pope could give me a little pat on the head now.
Right.
But of course, she talked very, very profoundly about aging and her view of feminism and all the choices she made, which I hadn't.
Oh, I want to hear that. Yeah, I'll look for that.
Yeah, you know, about her, just you know, her kind of obituary in the Times spelled out so much. I didn't know that she had left two children at a young age, you know, with her husband, and really went off on this, on, you know, at the time was quite a radical path. And
well, the Golden Notebook really did change a lot of lives. I mean, I remember reading it as a young person. It was profound. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing book. It is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it still isn't.
But I don't feel that way about the MacArthur. I would never say I couldn't care less.
Right.
I mean, for me, it definitely was. You know, I mean, I had to remember where I came from a, you know, lower middle class family with no art, no culture. I made it all on my own. I mean, I developed this language all on my own and took years to do it because I knew it was so important to me that, you know, I didn't take any, you know, take any leaps or, I just did what I had to do for many, many years. And so getting the MacArthur was amazing.
It is amazing. I wouldn't react like Doris Lessing either. I think I would, you know, react like one of those people who, you know, those sweepstakes commercials, they come to your door and they start screaming or something. No, that's not quite me, but, So it brings us up to the present. Perhaps you're working on a series of paintings, and
I'm working on a series of paintings. Basically, was without a gallery for the last 3 years, but I did have a few shows in New York last year, and so that was good. At Gearing and Lopez, where I had a show of early works on paper and some new paintings, and then I had a paper pulp painting show at Tierney's Yard at a gallery called Kristen Tierney Gallery, and which has now become Tierney's Yard Iran because Kristen and Denise Jardaran have become partners. And that I will be my new affiliation. I mean, that's where I will be showing next. And so that's something brand new for me.
And what do you think is the, I mean, I don't want to talk about content in your painting, perhaps, but as you've said, you know, they've reflected different aspects of your life and what you're going through, and you know, there was a dark series, you know, a series where there's, you know, different things happening that reflect different things to you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk at all about what's happening now? Not that that the paintings are illustrative of that, but that's part of what's going on.
What's happening now in the studio, you mean? Or
in the studio, and what do you think is influencing the paintings now? What do you, you know, you're at a point in your life where, I mean, I imagine there's much less, you know, tension, difficulty, chaos.
I wouldn't say that necessarily. Well, I definitely would not say that. Not that I'm going to get into anything, but you know, I've had some pretty high drama in my family. And, you know, everything's reflected in the work. On the other hand, the work has its own trajectory. You know, it's like the work develops as the work develops. And my work has always, you know, been very connected to music and my going to concerts and making sketches and getting ideas and you know, and whatever personal drama may or may not go into the work, it always has to do with, you know, I don't know, just a very careful editing of myself and a kind of development over many years of a language that I've you know, put together and then can grab from the vocabulary. But it's also very landscape based. I mean, you know, and when our house in this little hamlet called Willow, New York, was in the woods with ponds and pine trees, and it was dark, and the paintings reflected that, you know. And now this new house that we have has the most magnificent mountain views, and I think that the work reflects that kind of thing, you know, the landscape that I'm looking at. So it's not only what's going on in my life, but the, you know, the all the landscape and like I have a studio now full of dried sunflowers that friends of mine collected for me, and dried flowers and roots, and all that stuff will end up in paintings this winter, I'm sure. You know, and if I do get to the wasteland, it's going to be part of that picture. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. It does answer my question.
You know, I made a painting a few years ago called Break Into My Heart So Needy. And it was, you know, I don't play the recorder anymore, but I used to love the recorder. And there was a Bach piece that I found in my recorder music called Break Into My Heart So Needy. And I cut out pieces of it and made copies on rice paper and Japanese paper. Anyway, so I made this small, gorgeous painting called Break Into My Heart So Needy. And yes, it reflects something that was going on, but the interesting thing is that people look at this painting and they bring themselves to it, and they bring their own lives to it, and they bring their own, you know, drama to it or whatever. Everyone interprets it differently. There's not one person who turned to me and said, "Was your heart really broken in two?" Or, "What was this about?" Or, you know what I mean? So,
right.
So my theory is that you can almost say or do anything in a painting and no one's going to get it anyway completely. You know, they're just going to bring themselves to the painting and look at it. And it's got to be not about me. It's got to be, you know, it's got to, I have to bring it to someplace more universal for sure.
Hmm.
So I do try to do that.
That makes sense. And so this has been, it's been really wonderful talking to you and hearing about, you know, how you move through life as a painter. There's a lot of the listeners of this show are artists that aren't just students, but they're from a lot of different places, as well as older artists. In closing, is there anything you want to say to them? I mean, a lot of them are listening to this thinking, you know, it's exciting to hear you, and they're comparing it to themselves, thinking, oh, but, you know, she was at this time or doing this or that, and I can't do that now, or I can't really say what they're thinking, but there's this whole sense of how different artists develop in different ways, and you don't have to address that directly, but is there anything you want to say to that group of ears out there?
Do your yoga. I think for me, I don't think you can solve art problems but by making art. In other words, it's another language altogether. So you have to just be in there and doing it. And then hopefully get someone or a group, you know, friends or whoever to look at your work and to react to it if you can. Because, you know, somebody many, many years ago, a friend of mine said, well, we make art to make people love us. And in some ways, I think that that might be true. You know, we really make art because we're making it, I mean, as a generous act or trying to get people to understand us. Or, you know, I once made a painting called, where I wrote the words, tell me in any way you can, which means, you know, let's try to communicate in any way we possibly can. So I think, I don't know. I mean, I think hard work is the answer. I mean, you just have to be in there, and you also have to love it. And if you're not obsessed, there's no point in trying to be an artist or to make art. I mean, I really think that you have to be very obsessed to want to do it or continue doing it or, you know, somehow get deeply into it. And you also have to love doing it. I mean, I absolutely love being in my studio almost more than anything. It gives me peace. It gives me quiet. It lets me express myself. So I don't, you know, it's not like I have any answers. I mean, I listened this morning to Marilyn Minter's interview, which I loved. And at one point she says, no one escapes, you know, the difficulties that everyone has in an art career. And it's true. No one escapes any difficulties in life or in career. We might think that, oh, well, that person's really making it and that person's doing so much better than I am and making so much more. But no one, you know, we all have problems. I mean, and we all have, you know, insecurities. And, I mean, I'm insecure as anybody else, you know, and I really am. And that's why I'm in my studio every day, you know, to try to overcome all of that. Anyway, does that answer anything?
It does. I think that answers a lot. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.